Hello, and welcome to I Am the Eggpod, with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this bonus episode, we're going to be speaking to BBC Radio 4 and 4 Extra producer, Laura Grimshaw.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
How
Thank
are you?
You for having me. I'm very well, yes. I'm, you know, sitting in the room that I sit in all the time and talking to people on Zoom, but that's fine, you know, I'm very used to that now.
I've got to say, your programme Dip My Brain in Joy, which is a three-part series on Neil Innes, is the best thing I've heard on radio for a long time.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very nice to say. I mean, it was a real, I think labour of love is probably an understatement, but I worked with Neil and I knew him and I adored him and I was a fan of his before I met him. And I mean, I'll probably go into this more as we talk about him, but he was very kind and generous and lovely to me very early in my career. And I sort of feel like I owe him my career and my life with the advice that he gave me. So I adore the man. And so getting to make a programme that sort of tried to capture some of his joy and his brilliance, it was nice to sort of take time and actually share a lot of his music and a lot of kind of unheard things and troll the archive and get some real kind of unheard, lovely things. Yeah, it was a real kind of honour and privilege, and I'm sort of very grateful to everybody who was involved, particularly to Yvonne, his wife, who, you know, shared some lovely stories and was really encouraging while I was making it, sitting again in this room on my own.
What a room.
Yeah, it's a lot's happened in here.
Anybody listening to this who loves Neil Innes, have a listen. It's on the Sounds, BBC Sounds app. And you spoke to everybody involved in the music of the Ruttles.
Yes.
And I think the overarching feeling is that nobody had a bad word to say about him. He was just loved by everybody he worked with.
Yeah, I think that's true. Certainly my experience of him as well. I think he was genuinely really creative and also just wanted it to be fun. So, well, it was Phil Jackson, who was the keyboardist in the sort of last iteration of the touring Ruttles band. He said that Neil said in a rehearsal, if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong. And I think that was Neil's attitude to everything throughout his whole career. And it clearly started with the madness of the Bonzos, but I think he wanted to do things that were fun. And it wasn't about fame or money or recognition or anything like that. It was just kind of going, this looks like fun. This will be a fun project. I think I can make something of this. And some of it was successful and endured, much like the album we're going to be talking about.
The album that we're going to be talking about today is the 1978 soundtrack of All You Need Is Cash by the Ruttles. So we're talking about Ron Nasty, Dirk McQuickley, Stig O'Hara and Barry Wom. But I think obviously the story starts with Eric Idle's sketch.
The whole thing was a sketch on Rutland Weekend Television. And so basically Rutland Weekend Television was a sketch show. It was the first thing Eric Idle did after Monty Python. In fact, it was the first post-Python project that happened with anybody. So Eric Idle had a BBC Two series, and it was on for two series and a Christmas special in 75 and 76. And when they were making it, as part of my programme, I spoke to Ian Keel, the producer, so I'm now just regurgitating what he told me. But Eric got this commission, and Eric suggested to the producer to get Neil on to do music. So do like three or four funny songs or, you know, odd little songs in between the sketches. And then they had this sort of core group of actors who appeared in all the sketches, and Neil was one of those, and he was in sketches as well. I really love Rutland Weekend Television. There are some bootlegs, not that I should be, as a BBC producer, I shouldn't be recommending bootleg copies, but there are some bootleg copies around.
Try and be impartial.
I really love it. Like, it is a very much a post-Python thing, but it is very silly, and it's there's some great stuff in there.
They literally had no money.
No.
Didn't they blow all their money on costumes, didn't they?
Yeah, it was made on a continuity budget. I like the low budget, just trying to make something fun and entertaining, and hopefully this will do. And they regularly used up their budget and, you know, spent it all on costumes or, you know, just run out of money. But yeah, so as part of that, Neil would sort of provide two or three songs a week. Neil sort of said he'd quite like to do a Hard Day's Night kind of parody and bits of Black and White all running around, that kind of thing. And Eric said that he'd got this idea for a documentary maker who was so boring the camera kept running away from him. And so they combined those two things of having a very boring documentary about the Beatles, but not the Beatles, and they were called the Ruttles because of Rutland Weekend Television. And that song was I Must Be In Love, which is on All You Need Is Cash. So that was the first song that was written. And then it sort of got a bit out of hand at that time, because it obviously wasn't that long after the Beatles had split up. Seven, 8 years later. So on Saturday Night Live, George Harrison appeared and they were sort of doing this joke about, we'll give you $20,000 if you can get or $20,000 if you can get the Beatles back together. And George was like, well, all this for me? And they're like, no, well, you've got to split it between the four of you, but you don't have to tell Ringo if you want, and that kind of stuff. So it was like, this is a Saturday Night Live sketch with Lorne Michaels. And at that time, Eric Idle was booked as a guest host, so he did an episode with him as well, and he said that he could get the Beatles back together for £300. Yeah. But it turns out it was a bad phone line, and actually what he's got is the Ruttles, and they played I Must Be In Love from Rutland Weekend Television on Saturday Night Live. And the American fans of Saturday Night Live went mad for it. And they were like sending in their Beatles albums with like the Beatles crossed out and the Ruttles written on it and stuff like that. Like it was sort of this sort of mad fandom happened about the Ruttles. So Lorne Michaels sort of went, well, we should probably do something with this. And they were sort of sitting around kind of talking about making a film. And the way Neil tells the story is that they were sort of talking about, oh, yeah, no, like Eric can definitely write something, and, you know, we can put something together and we can probably get some celebrities in it and to have them talking about the Ruttles like they were fans, blah, blah, blah. Towards as the meeting went on, they sort of slowly turned to Neil and went, so do you think you can provide another 20 Ruttle songs by next week? which he obviously did.
Yeah. Covering the whole span of the career.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's an extraordinary album, I think. I mean, I think very famously Neil said he never listened to the Beatles when he was... So he was a Beatles fan at the time. He was, in the 60s, was a fan of the Beatles. But he said that when he was writing Ruttle songs, he didn't go back and listen to them because he would have fallen into too many traps of it being... Like, trying to do that rather than actually... What he wanted to do and what he ended up doing was putting himself back in what he was doing at that time, how it felt to hear those songs for the first time and what effect that had on his life as a man in his 20s and being at college and meeting new people and meeting his wife and falling in love and all of these things. He sort of got the gist of the Beatles, the essence of it, and covered the whole career. And what's really lovely is hearing Neil talking about the Beatles and just kind of going, they were so good. They were so good and so inventive and so interesting because they did so many different types of music and so many different sort of genres and different... I mean, I'm not musical at all, so I'm going to stop trying to come up with words there.
But, and stuff.
Yeah, and stuff. Yeah, so they did so much stuff. But I think that's why Neil was able to capture it, because he had such a good ear for music and he did have an inventive, creative brain. Mm. And he could hear ways of sort of capturing and then subverting or then, you know, what I found really lovely when I spoke to John Altman about how they parodied stuff. So John Altman's musical arranger, he arranged all of the Ruttle songs and a load of other stuff. He's had an amazing career, amazing career. And it was great to hear him talking about how they worked together. So when Neil was writing the Ruttles album, he didn't listen to any Beatles songs, but when John was arranging it, he did listen to them. What I think is really interesting is that sort of Neil noticed kind of patterns of words and riffs and things like that. But the things that John captured and noticed was sort of like how there would be like a flute for one verse in one song, and then it would disappear. Yeah. And so they would do that. They did that when they replicated that when they came to make the album. It's
yeah. Well, I think on your program, didn't you mention about the cellists?
Yes, because again, it wasn't that long after the Beatles split up. They actually used some musicians who played on Beatles tracks, and the cellists. I mean, I like the phrase John Altman used. He said that they attacked the cello in the same way. That's what they did. It wasn't this sort of beautiful, gentle, flowing noise. They attacked it. It was the hard, yeah. it's a Beatles-y sound. And they've replicated that on some of the songs on the Ruffles album.
We've arrived. Great note there.
Right. And there's two separate entities, really. You've got the film and the album. Mm. It was George Harrison who kind of facilitated the release of the album by introducing to Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
But I think for me, why it works so well is the Beatles themselves were really, really funny people anyway. So if you're going to do a sort of parody spoof film about them, you're going to have to get ridiculously silly. So like the trousers and all this kind of thing, and Leggy Mountbatten bullfighters. It just has to be that surreal to make it even funnier than the Beatles. But if you think Neil had written sort of punchline songs, just very, very silly songs, it wouldn't have worked. There's so much warmth in his songs. It's just so subtle, and I think that's for me why the whole thing works.
Yeah, and that was sort of the interesting thing about how John Altman and Neil work together, and when they put songs together, is that they weren't poking fun. Actually were the attention to detail was beautiful, and they would work out how a song was done, and they would get right down to the sort of minutiae of it, and then create a sort of celebratory parody that put all the work that goes into the songs. And this is true of obviously the Ruffles and with the Beatles, but there are other parodies that they did together, like Elton John and Billy Joel, and that they are perfect. They're pitch perfect, but they're not mean. They're not, I think a lot of parody songs tend to be taking the piss out of the thing. Yeah. But that's not necessarily what parody is. And it's sort of, I think it's quite nice that the reason that the Ruttles, were still touring last year before Neil's death, they were still having adoring audiences and packed out places, because those songs stand up on their own, because they are good songs that capture the essence of the Beatles back catalogue. They're not piss-takey, they're not mean, they're just good songs that are done affectionately in a Beatley style.
I'm not the kind of guy who likes to play Big Brother, but I've just seen your date outside. He's with another. I saw you both come in, and clearly you're not meant for him. So please, please hold.
So should we move on to the album?
Yes.
And we start off with Hold My Hand, which is kind of mashes together elements of All My Loving, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, Please Please Me, into one song.
Yeah, and I think Hold My Hand is quite a good place to start, because I think it does illustrate that Neil wasn't trying to copy, he wasn't trying to parody one song. That's not what he was doing. He wasn't going, oh, I have to do a I Want to Hold Your Hand song, so I'm going to do that now. And I think people, because it's called Hold My Hand, I think people go, oh, well, it must be I Want to Hold Your Hand. But it captures all the songs of that particular era of Beatles. It's a bit of everything. And it's the essence he's captured with it. It is that kind of early 60s, young, tentative first kind of foray into falling in love and that kind of thing. He's captured all of that. He's captured all of those songs in that one song.
The thing that jumps out at me, he found it more difficult writing the early songs than he did the later psychedelic songs. He said, you just rhymed anything with anything else, but the earlier songs were difficult to get right. So it's the way his mind's working. He can quite happily do some psychedelic piggy in the middle.
Yes. oh, he can write absurd quite easily. I think absurd came quite easily to him. But yeah, I think those sort of, I suppose, boyish love songs, they are a particular type of music. And it's not a particular type of music that Neil was ever involved in, whereas Neil was professionally, you know, unrelated to any of this, involved in 60s psychedelia with the Bonzos. Yeah. So I think while I don't think the Bonzos were sort of taking themselves seriously, I think he could always poke fun at that sort of music.
Yeah. And there's a couple of lines that I like on this, because they're so subtle, but it's, and it really conjures the way the Beatles was worked at the time and the kind of lyrics they were doing at the time. And it's, I want to tell you I'm in love with you completely. I'd like to take you far away from here discreetly. And it's just, what a strange word to throw in there.
I think one of the things that with Neil's approach to songwriting, and it applied to whether he was writing his own songs or Ruttle songs or parody songs, or you know, whether he was trying to write himself a straight song to perform, Yvonne said that he would spend so much time getting the words right. So he wouldn't just go for the rhyme. He wouldn't, you know, she said he never did Moon and June. He would always spend time agonising over what the right word is. And I think, you know, in terms of hold my hand and, you know, and going away discreetly, I think it does capture, as I say, that first foray into love and that sort of boyish kind of charm. It's, you know, there's a lot that you could do if you're doing it discreetly. but, you know, you don't sing about that in the song. You talk about actually, you know, being polite and proper.
And we move on to track two, Number One.
Yes. And that, you know, that's a, I suppose that's more of a twist and shout kind of parody, which is obviously not a Beatles song. It is a Beatles song, but it's not a Beatles, you know, it's not written by Lennon and McCartney. Mm. So it's, but I think it's sort of capturing that era. Again, it's that thing that Neil said about just capturing a moment. And so it's a feel of the time rather than any particular song.
He had some great musicians. He had Ollie Housel on guitar and vocals, Ricky Fattah from the Beach Boys and Flame, John Halsey on percussion and vocals, Andy Brown on bass, and as you say, John Ortman doing the orchestral arrangements, and Steve James, son of Sid, engineered it. And it, I think you spoke to him as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And he was saying that he sort of feels like the Ruttles changed his life, because he was quite young at that point. I think he said he was like 23, 24, and it was one of his first jobs. Neil had worked at the studio before, and so sort of called and spoke to Steve and said, I want to capture 7 years of the Beatles in 3 weeks. And so Steve put his name down to work all of like to engineer all of those sessions. Like, he was like, I'm taking this album. I want to do this. And he'd worked at EMI previously, and so was a huge fan and had listened to all of their output and was just really, really excited about it. And he, you know, we were talking about the things he did to kind of make it sound Beatley. And the main thing he did, which I always find quite interesting, and which also means somewhere there are beautiful, pristine copies of the Ruttles. But what he did, he said, in his own words, he fucked them up. They sounded too high fidelity. So they had to make it sound like they were made in the early 60s. So he would compress them and, you know, damage the tapes and stuff like that. So he would actually ruin the songs. But it works. That captures that early 60s sound.
The way he pans the vocals to one side.
Yeah.
Exactly what George Martin did.
Yes, yeah. And he, so like, you know, the songs he's kind of, the early ones, so like Hold My Hand and Baby Let Me Be and Number One, they all sound a bit scratchy. And then when it gets into the kind of more psychedelic stuff, so like Love Life and Piggy in the Middle, I mean, Steve was saying he loved doing Piggy in the Middle. He just said he had so much fun messing around with it and just making it all kind of swirly and yeah, he said that was one of his favourites to do, because he just was allowed to kind of run riot with the post-production on it. But, you know, he had a huge input into how that album sounded. And, you know, when you talk to him about it, he says things like, well, I just put some microphones in front of some talented people and they did it all. Really downplaying it. But, you know, why it sounds so good and sounds so Beatly is because of Steve's input.
And one final thing on him, on your programme, his laugh. He's basically inherited his dad's laugh.
He's definitely, yeah, you can tell he's his father's son, which is, you know, quite a lovely thing to see. And what's also quite interesting about the early Ruttle stuff that's on the album, so all the musicians went and stayed together for 2 weeks in Hendon, the Hendon studio, and they basically rehearsed like a band so that they became a tight band, so that when they came to record they were like a touring band, like the Beatles. You know, they were a group of people who knew each other really well, could play together, had that chemistry. They made that happen, which is why, you know, Neil used musicians that he worked with a lot and that he was already friends with, already knew he could have fun with. You know, he'd done gigs with Fatso, which was John Halsey's band, and they were on Rotten Weekend Television, so they'd worked together already and they were already mates. So, and you know, Ollie Houser was an incredible guitarist, just mind-blowingly good. Yeah, he sort of surrounded himself with the best people, and then they went and rehearsed the hell out of everything. But they also recorded a lot of the stuff that they did there at Hendon. So actually, some of those early, slightly scratchy recordings are on the album as the hamburger days, as they say in the in the Ruttles. Yeah.
Shoot me down in flames if I should tell a lie. Cross my heart, I promise that it's true. I've been in love so many times before, but never with a girl like you. Hold and be beside with a girl like you to fill my heart with pride and joy.
So next we have With a Girl Like You, which I think we can safely say If I Fell would have been an influence.
Yeah, because when they'd done all the songs and they played it to George Harrison, because, you know, George was involved, George was around when they were recording, and Neil and George were friends, and With a Girl Like You, George's reaction to that one was, that's a bit close. Which I think is fair comment.
It is. We've got Ollie Housel on vocals here, and he was basically doing the Paul section.
Yes.
So why did Neil choose him over, say, Eric Idle, who would have been playing him in the film?
Well, so at that point, I think when they sort of first got together, I think the plan was that Eric was going to be the documentary maker so boring that the camera runs away. Eric was going to play that part and kind of narrate the film, and that they would have a band in as the band. But before they started filming anything, they sort of agreed that actually Eric should be in the band as well. Like, he should be in it more, because they would be, you know, selling it on his name as a sort of post-Python project and that kind of thing. So Eric then played the Paul McCartney character in the film. But actually on the album, all of his bits are sung and played by Ollie Housel, who was just an incredible musician. I mean, Steve James called it, the sound is perfect, and the guitar playing is amazing. Steve James, his description of Ollie Housel was, he was a freak. It's just, you know, so good, so unbelievably good.
I heard they had quite raucous drinking sessions after the recordings.
Yes. I liked how John Halsey told the story of them being in Hendon and, you know, rehearsing together. And it was during the summer, and Wimbledon was on. And he says that, so obviously Wimbledon was on, so we had to keep going and checking on how Wimbledon was at the pub. It's not because we were thirsty or even, you know, it's just we had to see what was happening with Wimbledon every now and then. So, yeah, I think they did a lot of drinking, and a lot of fun was had, I think.
Yeah. We can hear the fun in, it's not on here, but we've arrived and to prove it we're here.
Yes, yeah.
That is just joy.
Yeah,
they're
yeah,
just in hysterics on that.
Yeah, and it's lovely to hear that, you know, that that appeared on Archaeology, not on the original film, but yeah, they were a proper band. They were a proper band of people who got on well, who played well, and, you know, that's sort of... That's what you want from a band, really. That's why bands happen. That's why people play music together, because they're enjoying themselves and they can all play. So they were, you know, even though the Ruttles are demonstrably not a real band, they were a real band. They were a real band on the albums, and then, you know, in more recent years with them touring, they were a properly good band. They could play, and they were all amazing musicians who knew their music, and they had fun on stage playing to people who knew all the words to all the songs. Yeah.
They're effectively more like the Monkees.
Yeah.
In many respects, they were.
Yeah, they weren't a real band, but they were. They absolutely were a real band.
Yeah. This is one of the highlights in the film where Dirk is singing to the Queen.
Yes.
And his impression is quite brutal of Paul. It's that raised eyebrow.
Yeah.
Very sincere. And the lyrics are just a joy, because it's Paul's... He was very much known for doing things like A Taste of Honey, these very overly romantic things. And Neil's like, shoot me down in flames if I should tell a lie. Cross my heart, I promise that it's true. It's just so over the top.
Yeah. I mean, it is actually a really lovely song. It does stand up on its own. It's, you know, I saw the Ruttles a few times live, and it was just a set list of absolute bangers. You know, they were great. Yeah. And, you know, because the people who were in the audience, I suppose, never really expected to see the Ruttles live. Like, you know, it's not...
No.
If you enjoy the film and you have the albums and you enjoy the music, you still wouldn't necessarily expect to be able to see them year after year. But you get to, you got to, and everyone there loved every second of it. And, you know, they laughed in all the right places. They knew all the words. They would sing along. And it was a proper concert. You know, I sort of have nice memories of hearing With a Girl Like You live and hearing Neil sing it, because everybody was sort of enraptured, really. I feel good, I feel bad, I feel happy, I feel sad. Am I in love? I must be in love. I feel rich, I feel poor, I'm in doubt, I feel sure. Next, we move on to I Must Be in Love, or Love. Must Be in Love.
So this was the first song you were saying.
So yeah, so I Must Be in Love was in Rutland Weekend Television. So that was the first song to come out. So in the sketch, they did talk about a few other albums. So A Hard Day's Rut and things like that. They are all mentioned in the original sketch.
Yeah.
But this was the first song. This was the idea, a Dick Lester parody video, basically. So it was a black and white, lots of people, you know, four young boys running around in tight trousers was the brief.
And cheap, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was always the motivation for Rutland Weekend Television. It all had to be cheap. So in that original sketch, it was Neil and John Halsey, who was Barry Wom in the film. But then they had Eric as Paul McCartney in that film, and David Batley was also in it. So that was the four who were in that original sketch that was also shown on Saturday Night Live. But then when it came to make the film, things got moved around, and, you know, they put the band together to make the music and that kind of thing. But John Halsey was there throughout, and, you know, in his own words, he was like, I don't know why.
Because I think for you, it must have been a joy speaking to Steve James, John Halsey, John Altman about recording this. Are there any stories that you didn't use in the programme that you can share?
I mean, there
here?
Were so many. I genuinely do think I could have made, you know, 12 hours about Neil, because everybody had so many stories and so many funny stories of just them spending time together. There were quite a few stories about, like, you know, getting very drunk and doing very silly things, which is, you know, a lot of those didn't go in. But when they were recording at Hendine, he was saying that they would, you know, they would go and watch Wimbledon is the new euphemism for going to the pub for a drink. And Steve was saying that Ollie would like walk back from the pub along cars. Like they would get so smashed in the day that they would like walk not on the pavement but along cars. And Steve said he had images of Neil just going, Ollie, stop it, get out, stop it. I think a good time was had by all when they were rehearsing. Yeah, and you know, I like the idea of Neil trying to keep order the whole time. That was always Neil's thing. You know, he liked fun, but his role tended to be the one that kept everyone going and kept everything in order. And you know, actually, we're having fun, but also let's go back to the work and let's loop it back and go to the work. And you know, that was his role in the Bonzos for certain.
I was going to say, because that's a similar relationship. I mean, he's working with Viv Stanchel and the Pythons. Mm. Graham Chapman, I think, he was friends with as well, wasn't he? So he must have had to play Mother.
Yes, I think so. One of my favourite fun facts about Neil is he's one of only two people other than the Pythons credited with writing on Monty Python's Flying Circus. The other one's Douglas Adams. And yeah, wow. Neil wrote with Graham for Series 4 because John Cleese did some bits on screen, but he basically left. He wasn't involved that much. And Michael Palin basically said that they needed all the help they could get. So they sort of called upon trusted friends who they knew kind of got it. They got Python. They had that similar sort of sense of absurdity and fun. So Neil wrote with Graham. So he wrote Appeal on behalf of Extremely Rich People, which Graham Chapman performed. But it's just sort of explaining how hard it is being very rich and how they need your help. He also wrote with Graham, he wrote The Most Awful Family in Britain, which is also in Series 4. And one of the most disgusting sketches.
Ouch, you're breaking my heart. Ouch, I'm falling apart. Ouch, 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 ouch. When we first met, I must admit, I felt for you. Now when we meet all kinds of things, it seems upset the apple cart. All kinds of things, it seems upset the apple cart. Ouch, don't desert me. Ouch, please don't hurt me. Ouch, ow, ow, ow.
We move on to track 5, Ouch.
One of the things I love about Ouch is the arrangement of the backing vocals, which are complicated, to say the least. And Neil always sort of seemed pleasantly surprised when people that he was performing with, so like, because the Ruttles touring band kind of ended up being Neil and John Halsey, and then a group of people who were just fans. That, you know, they were proper musicians, but they were fans, so they knew it and they loved it. And I think Neil was always surprised and amazed that people would turn up knowing the backing vocals to Ouch. I mean, you know, if I could sing, I think I could do it, but not going to. No one needs that.
But it's done the same thing as Help. You know, you've got the backing vocals. It's a weird format for a song. You've got the backing vocals first before the singer sings.
Yes.
And it was kind of thrown that all over the place.
Yeah, he's taken something that was already a bit complicated and a bit unusual and original and messed around with it even more. And the guitar parts on it as well are, I mean, it's Ollie Halsall doing it originally. Yeah. And then Ken Thornton playing with the live band, he could always nail it as well. It's quite something, Ouch, for such a short, quick song. There's so much in it.
It's under 2 minutes. It's 1 minute 49.
Yeah. But there is so much happening.
And I think throughout the whole album, they're all kind of 2-minute songs. They're not much longer. And to cram, like you say, all of these songs have got so much in them.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult to do that in a 2-minute song.
Yes.
His songwriting should be shouted about more.
Yeah. I think Neil is underrated generally. I think, you know, and I think part of his, I'm going to say problem, but I don't know that it is a problem, but I think part of the thing with that, the reason he's not as well recognised for stuff is that he did lots of things. So he tried out, you know, he did some film music and he did serious songs and he did parody and he did songs for children. And so he did all sorts of different types of music. And it's an observation Yvonne made. It's like, you know, if you saw him as a comedian, you wouldn't book him as a serious musician. But he was a serious musician. And if you saw him as a serious musician, you perhaps wouldn't get him to do your comedy stuff or your, you know. So it was sort of, he kind of straddled music and comedy and was so good at both of them. And I think that meant he wasn't as celebrated for either as he should have been.
And his acting, especially in this.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, his Lennon is perfect. But again, I think...
Brilliant.
I think his impersonation of John Lennon is done in the same way as the songs were, in that he's captured a sort of essence of the man.
Yeah.
But also there is this attention to detail, this thing of noticing little mannerisms that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on unless you were... You had that sort of mind that saw these details.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, just the things he picks up on and then puts into his Lennon impression is what he did with the songs, I think. Ouch, don't desert me. Ouch, please don't hurt me. Ouch, ow, ow, ouch. Ouch, don't desert me. Ouch, please don't hurt me. Ouch, ow, ow.
With the footage, because George Harrison had a direct impact on that as well, because it was what eventually became Anthology. Just after the Beatles split, Neil Aspinall was putting this film together, The Long and Winding Road.
Yeah.
Eric was given that, wasn't he, to use as reference.
Yeah.
And they did such an amazing job.
Yeah, with the film and the music and everything. Just one of the archive interviews I listened to with Eric talking about making the film, he said that it was quite a joyful thing because... Everyone involved was actually fans of the Beatles, so they were all really going for it to get it right and really enjoying, like, getting the outfits and the costumes and the wigs and the, you know, all of these little things that all combined. So everyone was really paying attention or knew it. They just knew it because they were fans. So everyone involved on every level got their bit right. So therefore, the film looks right and the music sounds right and... the way, you know, the words and the way the words are said is right. It's just this, on every level, the attention to detail is there. And so it all together just makes it for this, you know, perfect thing, perfect parody.
Absolutely. Right, it's time. Barry Warren. Country beside a chicken shack, so I left for the city and I didn't look back. Now I'm living in hope, living in hope, living in hope, living in hope. Yes, I'm living in hope, living in hope, living in hope, living in hope,
living in hope.
I think a few people have said this on this podcast that this could be the one Ruttle song that improves on the Beatles original.
I mean, you know, I'm going to take issue there because I think I'm probably more of a Ruttles fan than I am a Beatles fan. But I know that that's, you know, your listeners are probably going to come after me for saying that.
No, but, I said it.
But, yeah, I mean, Living in Hope is brilliant. I mean, John Halsey is so, so funny. So when I interviewed him, and again, I didn't have time for this in the program, but he was saying that the fact that, you know, as the drummer in the Ruttles, he had to sing because, you know, what the Beatles did, the Ruttles had to do. He was really laughing, telling me, just going, you know, I'm a terrible singer. I'm such a terrible singer. And, you know, he followed Neil's instruction, and Neil's instruction was to do it Liverpudlian. I mean, it is a great song. It's one of the highlights of the live shows. Because I said that to John. I said, you know, it was always a highlight seeing you do Living in Hope. And he was like, well, I made it a highlight. He's like, I had to do lots of things around it because I'm such a terrible singer. So, you know, he would kind of... you know, there would be a drum solo in it that would go on far too long, or and he'd take a phone call during the drum solo, you know, or he'd do a newspaper solo where he'd tear up a newspaper, or he'd, you know, he would really do, or he'd do like magic tricks while he was drumming and singing. I mean, it's just, it was just absolute nonsense, but he's so funny, and I love the Barry Wom songs.
Yeah, why I love this so much, because you think the White Album, obviously this Don't Pass Me By from the White Album, and the whole album is quite serious rock, you know, it's taken very seriously by rock critics, so you try and imagine what this would be like on the album, and it's just the lines like feeling like a cowboy and looking like a slob. You just wouldn't get that psychedelic 1968.
No. It's so funny. I can't listen to that, or you know, or Easy Listening on Archaeology. I know we're not talking about Archaeology, but the Barry Wom songs are just they're just great. They're so good.
There's a lot to be said about that Keep Calm and Barry Wom.
Yes.
So track 7, Love Life.
Yes, which is, you know, I think more obviously All You Need Is Love. On the original Hen Dean recording, it had the Monty Python's Flying Circus music as the intro, and then that got changed for the album. that's my little fun fact for you. John Altman changed it. He felt it was a bit too on the nose.
Yeah, but again, it's the attention to detail in the film, especially.
Yeah,
where they've recreated that Our World footage.
Yes,
it's perfection.
And you know, I think they they do kind of have the same sort of message.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe I'm undermining All You Need Is Love, but
well, they're both, well, you know, All You Need Is Love. Love is all you need.
Yeah,
love is the meaning of life.
Life is the meaning of love.
It's that very kind of simple sloganeering.
Yes, yeah.
But it still means it's a nice meaning.
Yeah, that song, you know, that was a direct request. They wanted to do All You Need Is Love in the film. So that had to be there. So, but again, you know, Neil didn't listen to it. He just knew the song. So it's how it kind of felt in his head. But then when you match that up with the video from or the film footage, it's... it is that, isn't it? It's just that. It is right there. Yeah. All of it is right there. And, you know, that thing I said about, you know, all the like, costume department and stuff being excited about, like, getting it right. They all got it right. And, yeah. You know, that is kind of a real illustration. And even, like, the fact that the way the film is treated kind of looks like it's a live American broadcast. And so it's got that same kind of graininess to it. All of it is bang on.
Yeah. And there's even a reference at the end of All You Need Is Love, where he's singing, "She loves you, yeah,
yeah, yeah."
And it's very, hold my hand in, really out of key.
Yeah.
We end side one with Stig O'Hara's first track on the album, Nevertheless.
Ricky Fattar is the George Harrison character in the film. He was the quiet one, and so he doesn't say a thing in the whole film. which is, you know, a nice touch.
The thing I love about this is Kevin Eldon did a brilliant interview on the Rule of Three podcast.
Yes.
And about the lyrics of this. It's just, you think... the original earnest lyrics that George put on things like Within You, Without You and Love You Too, And it's Neil's take on that is just, it's not my cup of tea. It's all the same to me. We are here today and gone tomorrow. Nevertheless, make the most of it. It just kind of brings sort of something your nan would say.
Yeah.
Just love how he's playfully bursting George's serious.
Yeah, lyrics. He probably felt like he could do that because they were friends and George was sort of involved and, you know, all of that. So it's, you know, I think maybe he felt he could be a little bit more, I'm not going to say mean, but hitting the nail on the head quite hard.
Because we can't underestimate George's involvement in this. He absolutely loved it.
Yeah, he really did. And, you know, he was friends with Eric and friends with Neil. And you know, it's that thing you were saying earlier. The Beatles were funny guys. Like, they, you know, that was part of their appeal. You know, and George was obviously involved, you know, part of Handmade Films and got the Python films released and all of that. So he wanted all of this stuff to exist. And, you know, there's that famous George Harrison line when they came to do Archaeology. And Neil was sort of a bit reticent and kind of didn't really want to overdo it. And he asked George for his thoughts and George said, it's all part of the soup. So he liked the fact that the Ruttles existed as, you know, as part of the in Beatles lore. It's, you know, it's all part of the same thing and it all has its own place and, you know, keep adding to it. Why not?
Because the thing I love about it is because obviously in 68 there was the Apple held their party and the Hell's Angels arrived.
Yeah.
And they redo that in the film with George as the interviewer interviewing Ron Wood. And it's obviously something happened there because he would have known he was there.
Yeah.
And he seems genuinely angry when he says, who hurt Stig? It was Big Valerie.
George is really, really good in there. In the film.
Oh, yeah.
And when he interviews Michael Palin as the head of Apple Corps about, like, you know, have there been any thefts? And there's just people streaming out of the building behind, just stealing everything, like people carrying phones and desks and stuff like that, with Michael Palin sort of repeatedly going, no, there hasn't been anything. So, you know, George was really part of it. He was a real part of it. And I think he sort of guided and advised with making the music and with making the film. I think he sort of, you know,
yeah.
I mean, Neil sort of said a nice thing in one of the interviews I found in the archive, where he sort of said that actually the end of the Beatles and the way it all ended and the way it all kind of fell apart, if you want, and then, you know, then what happened subsequently, it is all quite sad, and the fans never really got over them going. Like, they just wanted more. They always wanted more, but that, you know, they couldn't cope with doing more, I suppose. And it does sort of end quite sadly. And I think George sort of liked the Ruttles for the sort of calling out the absurdity of the whole thing, of how, you know, how mad it all was and how involved all the fans were, and how pointing out the fun of that and actually laughing at it. It was sort of quite an important thing, I think, for George. And I think that's possibly why he was so involved. Rather than it ending sadly, I think actually keeping it going in this way and it being funny is a good thing.
And I guess also, so, you know, the Beatles went through so much sadness, obviously, when Brian Epstein died. Mm. And in this version, Leggy Mountbatten quits to take up a teaching post in Australia. And there's that lovely scene where they're seeing Arthur Sultan at the time.
Yes.
I love the way they do this. They just burst that bubble. Obviously, you've got the shocked and stunned, but it's when they say, because they asked this to the Beatles, they said, did the Maharishi have any advice? And then they come out with all this mystical.
Yeah.
But obviously, the Ruttles version is no. And then Dirk is like, well, yeah. And then Ron's, well, yeah. And no. He said it took all sorts to make a world. And again, it's what your gran would say.
Yeah, it's just meaningless platitudes. Hour after hour in an ivory tower, a thousand and nothing to do. Spending the day in a colorful way, blue upon blue upon blue.
So we flip over to side two and we start with Good Times Roll. I think we can safely say this may be inspired by Lucy in the Sky.
I think that's probably fair. My feelings on Good Times Roll, again, it's one of the highlights of the live shows of in recent years because of Barry Wom's drum solo in the middle of it. So long, and
it's not a song you'd immediately think of having a drum solo,
no,
is it?
No, but oh, he made the most of it. And it, again, this didn't go in the program, but John was sort of saying that he really doesn't like drum solos. Like he sort of when he has to play on a track that has a sort of drum solo in it, like you know, properly, he always sort of felt nervous about the drum solo coming up, and he liked to sort of get it out of the way. And I think with the Good Times Roll, when they did it live, he would sort of kind of poke fun at the idea of a drum solo being a thing, and it would just be this long, laborious, drawn out thumping. I mean, I've not heard it, I've never been able to hear it, but seeing it live and also hearing it on CD, I've never heard it and not laughed at the drum solo.
Yeah.
It's that who knew that drum solos could be so funny?
Because they were taken so serious. I think you think bands like Cream in the 60s and Zeppelin, obviously.
Yeah.
And they're just redefining what should be some pretentious, meaningful moment into that.
I mean, this is the thing. John Halsey is a properly funny man. And the fact that he can drum in a funny way, he can hit drums and get laughs, I think is impressive. And actually, you know, skipping back a little, the drum intro to Living in Hope, I think that's really funny. I rarely hear that without laughing. It's just, again, it's just slightly offbeat and slightly awkward. And
good old Barry.
Good old Barry.
And the lyrics in here, I mean, this is what I say, you know, like Neil found these much easier than the one and one is two kind of thing.
Yeah.
But like drifting along on a cotton wool cloud, dreaming of drum majorettes, swastika nightingales croon, tongue in cheek, an elephant never forgets. And it's just... but it's just as meaningless as Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I refuse to believe that one is genius and one isn't. So I'm going to say they're both genius. People were proud in double back alley. Neighbours were loud, but ever so pally. People would shout, joking about the smoke and the soot.
And then track two, Double Back Alley. And again, we've got Ollie Housel on vocals here. For me, I have to say, I think this is a lyrical masterpiece.
It is. I mean, it's truly evocative. With Neil's sort of way of putting things together and getting the right words. So in terms of capturing an essence, he's not only captured the essence of Penny Lane, but he's captured the essence of that sort, living in that sort of community. And that's impressive because I know that's not his background. That's not where he grew up. He didn't live in these places. But again, I feel like he's captured it. People would shout, joking about the smoke and the soot. Mother would put the milk bottles out. I mean,
and it ends with mother would take the milk bottles in.
Yeah,
so you've got a whole day in the life.
Yes,
of Double Back Alley.
Yeah, it's a really. It's a beautiful song. And, you know, play peekaboo with Saka and Sally and all of that kind of stuff.
Showing her drawers.
Yeah.
But you can, even that line, showing her drawers, you come indoors, her dad would call.
Yeah.
It's like a little mini soap opera in two lines.
It really is. It's, you know, all the drama of Coronation Street in one song. You know, the lyrics are art, I think. The way the chosen words and the rhymes are just really beautiful.
Double Back Alley's a lot rougher than Penny Lane.
Mm.
some of the characters, I mean, Father O'Malley clipping your ear.
Yeah.
And steer you clear of the funny man in the ice cream. You know, there's a lot going on in
there
this alley.
Is, yeah.
Oh, I love it. And it's just musically as well. It's, I mean, Penny Lane, there's a lot of stealth chords sort of getting it from different keys.
Yeah.
And Neil effortlessly does it. The musicianship on this is beyond words.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I, you know, it's definitely the combination of Neil and John Altman together just making this perfect song of, you know what it's parodying, yet it's not actually anything like it. Lyrically, it tells a story. Musically, it's beautiful. It's a really, and you know, it's a comedy parody song. Look at the work that's gone into this piece of art.
And again, you were saying about John Altman, his arrangement of this is, this is where you've got the flutes coming in every now and again. And the brass section is just so spot on.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, this is this. So John said about listening to Penny Lane and hearing a flute on one verse. So there is a flute on one verse of this, and then it goes, just disappears. The details, they're all there. Everything is there. The affection and the almost like the patience that goes into like crafting these parodies is something else entirely. It's amazing.
Track three, Cheese and Onions.
I mean, I sort of feel like there is nothing I can say about this and you should just play it. I don't feel like there's anything I can add.
It's a biggie.
It is. It's a biggie and also just such a stupid song.
Yet genuinely moving.
Yes.
About cheese and onions.
The choice of the rhymes. He's not just gone for the obvious words and the obvious meanings. I think it is, again, so well crafted, even though it is kind of nonsense. But, you know, beer has been like a dinosaur.
And it's the inclusion of, on the lyric sheet as well, when it's C-H-E-E-S-E-A-N-D-O-N-I-O-N-S. Ono is spelled Ono.
Yes.
It's just all that detail. But it's, I think, because there's footage of him doing this last year. I mean, he was still doing this last year.
Yeah.
Which is surreal, isn't it? And people in the audience holding up the letters.
Yes.
And it's so moving. He looks so happy.
Yeah. The thing about those Rustles gigs is that it was just full of people who loved the film, loved the album, loved Neil. And so everyone was just really happy to be there. And they knew all the words. And I think that always delighted Neil. I think whenever he did shows and people turned up and they knew his work, I think he always seemed so pleased that people knew.
Again, going back to the film, the footage of this is just astonishing. And it is so resembles Yellow Sun. I think they got George Parker and Tony White to do the animation of this. But it's, again, it's Monty Python-esque version of a film that is already surreal.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You got flying gloves, so replace them with false teeth.
Yes.
You can only get more bizarre.
But again, the parody is right.
Another thing about the live shows, I mean, the last note of A Day in the Life, that final boom, is legendary within rock. And Neil's taken that, and again, footage of him doing it live, and he's kind of got his finger way up there above that note. Boom. And it's so powerful.
Yes, when I talked to John Altman, apparently that was his contribution. That's his favourite offering, that he did the last note on that. That was his suggestion. So, but then Neil, you know, obviously loved it and really ran with it for when he did it live.
Oh. At times like these, when enemies can number more than friends, a friend indeed is what I need, not someone who pretends. I'm on my way, I cannot stay another day.
And then we move on to track four, Another Day.
I think this is my favourite Ruttle song. I love this song. I just think it's beautiful. I love the piano on it. I love how simple it is. I think the words are brilliant. The way the sentences are constructed to get those rhymes. I really do think Neil is one of the greatest songwriters ever. And I, you know, when you look across his whole back catalogue, there's so many different types of music. You know, all his songs really say something. They all have a point. You know, yeah. when he felt compelled to write something, there is a reason he's writing it. Yeah, I just love this song. I just love it so much. It's just that mix of kind of poignant and funny that Neil did so well. And also, I have a very nice memory, if I can invoke some EggPod alumni, of being at one of the Ruttles gigs a couple of years ago and bumping into Jason Hazley and Joel Morris and Kevin Eldon, who were there together. And the first time I saw Joel was during this song, and we were sort of across the room from me, a little way across the room from each other, and we just sang to each other across the room. But like at that gig, so that was at the Garage in Islington. Like Stuart Lee was in the audience and Harry Hill was in the audience, and you know, there were so many people there making this program and kind of getting feedback from people. And, you know, seeing those people at his gigs, like, Neil was really loved. He was really, really well loved.
Oh, yeah.
Not just by the people who knew him and worked with him and kind of had a personal relationship with him, but actually just fans just really had a great affection for him and I think it's because he managed to straddle music and comedy so well, but then also in his songs, he straddles music and comedy so well. So he can have poignant, beautiful lyrics and then still get a laugh in the next line. And just the way he kind of deftly moves between those two worlds. He didn't do music and comedy. The musical comedy is so infused, and so both elements are as important as each other. And I think that's why these songs are so good, why they stand up, why you can sit and listen to this album without even knowing the Beatles. And actually, I think that's probably an interesting point to make. From my point of view, I think I knew about the Ruttles before I knew about the Beatles.
It's happened before.
I didn't know... Certainly when I, you know, I was so young when I saw the Ruttles. There's probably jokes in the Ruttles I still don't get, actually, because I don't know enough about the Beatles. But in my life, she says, launching into a Beatles song.
That's a Beatles song.
in my life, they've always existed together. I don't see the Ruttles existing because of the Beatles. They actually just exist alongside each other. And I'm quite happy listening to a Beatles song as I am... Well, I'm probably happier listening to a Ruttles song as I am a Beatles song. they exist side by side. I've never listened to the Ruttles going, oh, that's parodying that. You know, that's not how I hear it. I just hear them as these songs. And I think that's probably why I have such a huge affection for Another Day. Because I'm not listening to it through the prism of the Beatles. I'm just listening to it and going... This is a lovely song.
Because Neil was saying when he came on EggPod, he had a phone call and someone was saying, oh, we've just seen a load of park benches with inscriptions in. And one of them had, Another Day, I know they say that all the world's at stage, I'll play the fool, but as a rule, I'd rather act my age. And he was like, wow, he's made the benches.
Yeah.
He was chuffed.
Yeah. They're just beautiful lyrics. And also the fact that you can get a song with pusillanimous in it. I mean... There aren't many people.
Followed by, oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's. I just think the craft of Neil and the things he does so well are really shown in this in this song. I mean, in fact, it's shown in that. So you're so pusillanimous. Oh yeah, nature's calling, and I must go there. I mean, it's like immediate. You got a joke. You've got incredible wordplay. You've got. The juxtaposition of ridiculous words and oh yeah, and you know it's. I just think this song is perfectly illustrative of what Neil does so well. He does poignant, and he does interesting, and he does funny, and he does clever, and he has something to say, and he will say it in a beautifully crafted way. I know you know what you know, but you should know by now that you're not me. Talk about it among the Sundays. Talk about it.
So we come to the penultimate song, Piggy in the Middle.
When I spoke to Steve James about producing it, he said that this was his favourite one. One, because he was able to kind of run riot in post. But he also said that the first time he heard it, when he was in the studio with them and they played it, and that opening line of, I know you know what you know, but you should know by now that you're not me. And he said that it made him laugh so much he fell off his chair. Just for that to be the opening line of a song, and a song that goes on for another 7 minutes after that. I mean, that's where you're starting. Yeah. That kind of roundabout words and wordplay and how the words are, you know you're in for a ride, basically. And yeah, and I think Piggy in the Middle is sort of, I think it shows off the skills of everyone involved. So all of the musicians, of Neil's lyrics, of John Altman's arrangements, of Steve James's production, I think it's like this is what they're doing. This is they are parodying the Beatles, and look at everybody getting their bits right, and it is almost a celebration of what the Beatles did. Everybody captures it perfectly.
I was doing a bit of googling around the other day about the backward lyrics in this, and there are all sorts of weird connotations. I think because it gets confusing on the liner notes as well. It says Stig has been dead, honestly. What's it? Dead for ages, honestly.
Yes, yeah.
But it's actually not that.
It's not that, no.
It's this little piggy went to market, do a poo-poo.
Yes.
Instead of goo-goo, ka-joop, which is quite inspiring.
There's me talking about all of Neil's clever wordplay and how much of a genius he was. But yeah, I mean, you know, poo jokes, it's funny, right?
And the fade-out is just surreal with this little piggy went to market going on. And they're really getting carried away with this.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, when they performed it live, they'd all wear pig masks, and it was always a bit frightening. And apparently one of the first times they did that, they all put on the mask without Neil knowing. So he was just singing the song and they were all behind him playing with pig masks on. That's what Ken said at one point. So, yeah, and then that became a fixture of the live show. So then they would end up doing it with pig masks.
Time goes by, as we all know, naturally. People come and people go, naturally. Let's be natural.
And we end this fabulous album with Let's Be Natural. So there's some lovely footage of this in the film with Nasty, with his wife Chastity. And I think Gwen Taylor, who is also Mrs. Iris Mountbatten, is one of the highlights of this film.
Yeah, she's amazing. So Gwen Taylor was in Rutland Weekend Television, so she was one of the regular players, if you like, in all the sketches. And yeah, she is brilliant. And yeah, as... just I don't really want to talk about Nazis. I'm just trying to not say it. Yeah,
she had a strange father.
Yes, a very strange father. And you know, the whole sort of poking fun at the ridiculousness of all of the fuss around the Beatles, and the kind of, you know, the sitting in the bath and just sitting there with the shower dribbling on them.
For peace. I think it's also, I mean, they did such a good that the hatred for Yoko at the time, a lot of racism at the time. So to come up with, right, who can we give John stroke Nasty,
exactly,
worst possible wife?
Yeah.
So I think it's almost a comment on the press as well.
It is. It absolutely is. It's you know, they're not being mean about the Beatles, and they're not being mean about Yoko Ono. They're being mean about the ridiculousness that surrounded them. I think there's often a thing with Neil. You know, we were talking about him being underrated, and I think actually he possibly wasn't as famous as he should have been. But I think that was very deliberate on his part, because he was friends with people who were really famous. You know, he was friends with the Beatle, and he was friends with the Python. You know, he saw that happening to his friends, and I think he just found it so stupid. And why are people, why are people, we're all just people. Why are you losing your mind over that person and not this person? And, you know, I think he just found it all a little bit ridiculous and a little bit of a hassle. And I think he did shy away from fame. I don't think he really wanted a kind of, he wanted his songs to be known. And I think he loved it when people knew the words and he loved being recognised in that sense. But I don't think he wanted the fame for himself. And I think actually a lot of what he did when he would write satirical songs later in his career, he would always kind of poke fun at the big institutions and the media and the ridiculousness of fame and celebrity and show business and all of that. I think he found it a little bit distasteful, really. You know, I think he just sort of wanted to do things that some people liked and bring some joy to people and have a bit of fun and want, you know, bring that fun to other people. I don't think he wanted fame in that sense. And you know, John and Yoko portrayal in the film is that it is mocking that media anger and the sort of ownership of some people who were just ordinary people. They just sang some songs. That was it. Calm down. Yeah. I really think that is how Neil saw it, because he didn't see the world like other people.
Yeah. Tell me about, because obviously you said you worked with him, and then it became a friendship. How did that evolve?
Yeah, I don't know. I still find it a little bit crazy that I can even answer this question. So I've worked at Radio 4 Extra and Radio 4 for about 10 years. And on Radio 4 Extra, I work on the Comedy Club, which is 2 hours of radio comedy programs every night, and it's presented by comedians. So we have different comedians in, and we sometimes do kind of little extra sketches and extra production and stuff like that on a continuity budget, much like Rutland Weekend Television. Mm-hmm. And we also have interview guests. And quite early on, I was working with Arthur Smith, and I knew that the Ruttles were about to tour. So I decided, because I may as well use my career to meet my heroes, I thought I would try and get Neil on to talk about touring with Ruttles. That would be nice.
Absolutely.
And so I got in touch with Neil and booked him in to chat with Arthur, and Arthur knew Neil, and you know, it was a lovely lovely chat. And I can clearly remember going down in the lift the first time I met him, and I was on my own and I was just like deep breathing because I was so excited and so, you know, just don't even have words to describe how I was feeling. Yeah. Just absolute brain mind meldingly. I just love this man, and I have seen him in so many things, and I listen to him so often. And and then I worked with him, and he was utterly delightful. So the first time I met him, I got him to sign my Ruttles album, obviously. You know, I worked with him and I proved that I could do my job. And then I was like, just before you go, I just need to say thank you. I just need to, you know, so it got all gushing, and he was obviously very like, oh that's so nice, that's so lovely, you know. And then I got commissioned to make a program about Les Dawson, and I wanted to talk about the fact that actually Les Dawson was a brilliant musician. But, you know, the art of him playing the piano wrong is so perfectly done. And he does it so well because he can play the piano right. So he gets it wrong perfectly. I wanted a musical comedy genius to extol the virtues of that. And I got in touch with Neil and was just like, I don't suppose you could do that. And we spent a day recording Neil playing the piano like Les Dawson, which was great fun.
Brilliant.
He was just wonderful. And so, you know, his willingness to work with me again was great. And we, you know, we had a lovely longer time together then. And it was like, well, this is lovely. And then because I was making this program about Les Dawson, it was one of these 3-hour specials for 4 Extra. And obviously I had Neil's email address at this point, so we were sort of vaguely in touch. And I said, I don't suppose you would be interested in making one of these three hour things about Vivian Stanshall. He was up for doing it, and he presented it, and so we made a 3-hour program then. And making a 3-hour program is quite an intense project. And Neil and I spent a lot of time together, and I'm going to massively overshare now, but that's fine. So at that time I was going through a really awful breakup, and I had just moved to London, didn't really have any friends, didn't really have a life, didn't really know what to do. It was, you know, it was a bad time. And after a long day of recording, Neil offered to take me to dinner because he couldn't get his train. Like, he had to wait until the peak time had gone. So he was like, you know, I've got a couple of hours. Do you fancy going for dinner? And I was just like, yes, of course I do. My whole time spent with Neil was just me trying to not seem as keen to do things. So, like, yes, please. That would be amazing. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that sounds like a lovely idea. So we went to dinner and he was like, you know, I think we seem to be getting on well and this is all going very well and it's all very nice. He's like, but I don't really know much about you. So tell me about yourself. And I was like, well, actually, I don't know how to answer that question. And so, again, massively overshared with him. And he, basically, I'd been in that relationship since I was quite young. And so I didn't really know how to exist on my own, I think it's fair to say. And I sort of had told Neil about everything that was going on in my life. And he gave me some advice, which I think changed the course of my life. He said that when you enter into a relationship with someone, be it a romantic relationship or just a friendship, he's like, you need to see yourself as a circle. And when you meet somebody else, you overlap with them in certain ways. So you have certain things in common with them. So it's like a Venn diagram. And he's like, if you go into a relationship with somebody, you can overlap entirely. You can share everything, but you still have to be two separate circles. And he said to me that I was in a point in my life where I had the opportunity to build my circle. So I could work out who I wanted to be, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be known for, what I wanted to like. I could work all of that stuff out, firm up my circle, and then I can start trying to make friends. I could start trying to meet people. And it just seemed so simple. And I, you know, from that point on, it was like, yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So he taught me how to be a person. That's, I actually do think the person I am now is a result of that advice, getting that advice. I look back at how I was before I had that advice and I don't really recognize myself. Whereas, really? So when I say I think I owe him my life and my career, I really mean that. And shortly after I built my circle, I met the man I'm now married to, and my career started going well. And, you know, it changed the course of my life because it made me go, oh, I can choose the sort of person I want to be. I don't have to do it to please others. I can do it. And I can work out what I want to do, and what I like, where I get my pleasure. I can work out all of those things. And then I can just go and do it. I don't have to be beholden to anyone else now. And actually, before I start being beholden to anyone else, before I enter into friendships and relationships, I can work all that stuff out. So I can go, well, what do I want from them? What do I want to share with them? And yeah, it completely changed my life. And wow. I do feel like I owe him a lot. And then also, he was with Yvonne for 54 years, and their relationship was beautiful. Like, seeing them together was just the loveliest thing. And they really liked each other, and they really got on well, and they made each other laugh, and they worked together on stuff. And yeah, it was a, you know, to get, I sort of feel like getting a relationship advice from somebody whose relationship worked so well was quite an amazing thing. And then also then actually being able to work with him more solidly after that. So after we did the, you know, that was very early on in making the Vivstantial thing. We worked together for a good 2 or 3 months after that, you know, got on very well and it went really well. And my way of producing is to massively over-record. Like, you know, it's sort of like, what I do when I'm producing programs is I want people to enjoy it. I want my guests to be relaxed. I want them to have fun. I want them to enjoy reminiscing or telling stories or whatever. I don't want it to be question, answer. I want it to be a free-flowing thing. So I'm quite happy to sit and record for ages because that's how you get the best stuff. And I think Neil when he saw what I did with the edits, so where, how I got those stories together and how I tightened it all up and how I could make a 2-hour rambling chat into like a 5-minute interesting thing, I think he thought I was really good at my job. And so then we got permission to make an archive on four about the Bonzos. And we did that together. So we spent some time on that. And that was just before we moved to France. You know, we had a lovely time doing that. Just a great, he was just a joy to work with. And he was so full of ideas and he worked so hard and was fun the whole time. You know, it's quite an intense process working that closely with somebody, but it was always fun. We always had fun. The work would happen quite naturally because we were enjoying ourselves and we got on so well. And then my husband and I went to stay with Neil and Yvonne in France. We went, had a little holiday there, which was lovely. And went to see, you know, every time the Ruttles were in London, we'd go see them. And yeah, I just adore the man. And I think he was, I think he's brilliant. And I sort of feel very honoured to have got to spend any time with him, let alone to sort of see his mind work and how he creates and how he suggests ideas and how you can suggest something to him and then he'll run with it, or he'll sort of say a half-formed idea and then you can kind of suggest stuff and you build it together. And he was so collaborative and he really enjoyed working with other people, and I can only imagine what it must have been like to actually collaborate on music with him, because obviously, you know, that's not what my job was, and so I never got to do that. But I sort of feel like there must have been something quite magical about collaborating musically with him, because making radio with him was quite a magical experience, really. It was always really fun and really lovely, just a lovely experience. And he was so funny and so interesting and thought about things in a way very few people do.
So, Laura Grimshaw, thank you so much. Overall, usually we just say, what does this album mean to you? But I think it's a bit beyond that. What does Neil mean to you as Neil Innes and also your friend Neil Innes?
I just think he's wonderful as a sort of human being and also as a talent. I think he was deeply creative, and I think his sense of fun is something he sort of infused all his work with, but he also infused all his relationships with, like professional and personal relationships. I think that sort of sense of getting a laugh, of being silly, of, but without any, you know, I think sometimes people who are always trying to get a laugh might have, you know, massive egos, but he wasn't a massive ego. He, you know, he was clearly brilliant and he had no ego at all. He sort of always seemed to treat you as though you were as good as at your thing as he was at his. It's like, well, you know, you seem like a decent person, you must work hard and you're fun as well, so that'll do. And it's like, I feel like that was sort of how our relationship formed, and I feel like that's how he actually formed a lot of his relationships. That's certainly how people talk about him. That sense of fun is so prevalent in everything. As a fan, I am delighted for the joy he brought. And as somebody who knew him, I just feel like it was an incredible honour to be able to say that I was somebody who knew him and got to spend some time with him, because he is one of the best people I've ever met.
Laura Grimshaw, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the point where I ask, can you play a song that always makes me cry, Old Age Becomes Me?
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm knocking the microphone. That's going to be on the new album, actually.
Is it?
I used to think I could think things through. Now any notion I fancy will do. My lifetime's false is divided by true. Old age becomes me. So many memories to recall. Good times, bad times, big and small. Now like New England after the fall, old age becomes me. The sycamores and willows stand tall down by the stream. My blanket is a jacaranda blue. Among my extra pillows, I still know how to dream. Someday I'm gonna run away with you. A little different this tuning. I know life is much more than my limited attention span. Now all I do is all I can. Old age becomes me. Hum along at home, why don't you? Across the universes where all of us must go. Sooner or later, by and by. Oh, what is far, far worse is all those people in the know who claim they can explain the reasons why. I've had my fill of all the ballyhoo. Enough of soft shoe shufflers too. And as for the young and beautiful, well, you know what they can do. Old age becomes me.
Could have done with a little practice.